Can I ask you something? What's your family story worth to you? And I'm not talking about the shiny ones that everybody knows about. I mean the buried ones, the secrets, the heartbreaks, the ones that only slipped out after a night of too much Hennessy. That's what Vietnam Story Bank is for. No polish, no rewrites, no editing, just raw, recorded, beautiful beating history. The kind that makes you sit up and hold your breath. Your father's memories of his mother's wildest dreams, your grandparents' laughter that echoes in your bones. We dig it all up, we record it, and hand it back to you. Safe, untouchable, and unforgettable. Because when your stories disappear, they're gone forever. So go to VietnamStoryBank.com today and make sure your family's stories are recorded. Welcome back to Viet History Makers. I have my host here, Kevin Pham. Welcome back, Kevin.
Thank you, Ken. Good to be back. So I'll take this moment to remind the listener, well, I'll tell them welcome again to Viet History Makers. And just as a reminder, our goal in this series is simple. It's to understand how Vietnamese people understand themselves and their world. I play the role of professor, Ken plays the role of student, and what I do in this series is I reconstruct the thoughts of significant, influential historical figures. And I also want to mention that the word history is in the name of this show, but our focus is less on what happened in history and more on the thoughts and ideas of important people across the political spectrum. And I say that because I don't want people to think that I'm a historian. I am a political theorist, so I'm somewhat of an intellectual historian, but I'm less focused on what happened and events and things like that. I'm more interested in the ideas of people. I just want to remind listeners of that.
And you spend a lot of time at these coffee shops researching these folks. And just wanted to remind our listeners that, you know, we asked for a coffee for Kevin and I on our YouTube channel.
Yeah, that's much appreciated. I do have a job as a professor of political theory at the University of Amsterdam. I'm very busy, but I do try to take time out of my schedule to do this. It means a lot as a gesture of thanks and buying a coffee. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Today, you and I are going to be talking about a very interesting person. And my first question when you sent me the name was, why this person? And this person is Nguyen Khac Vien, lived from 1913 to 1997. And it's not the typical political figures that we've been covering, but I can imagine this is a very prominent figure in Vietnamese society nonetheless. That's a little less political, more, you know, in the prominent Vietnamese physician space.
Ooh. Not quite, Ken, not quite. But this is good. This is good. He's very political. But before I talk about Nguyen Khac Vien, let me step back a little bit and tell the listener that my interest has always been in Vietnamese responses to French colonialism. Mm. That just fascinates me. How do a colonized people respond to colonialism? By the way, listener, I want to announce that I have a new publication for you to check out. It's called Shame and Revolution, and it's published by a very well-known journal called Aeon, A-E-O-N. It's about Vietnamese anti-colonialism. It's written for a broad audience. Click on the link in the info box, but check that out. Okay,
you know,
back to...
I do want to ask you, before we move on, why do you think you are so into that period of anti-colonialism? I've always wanted to ask you that.
The answer is pretty simple. I grew up in San Jose, California, with one foot in punk rock Californian American culture. This was a culture of individualism, of rebellion, of anarchism, of leftism. And I had another foot in the culture of Confucian Vietnamese culture, going to Cung every month, right? And I could empathize. I could empathize with young Vietnamese growing up in the 1920s who felt also caught in between two worlds, the East and the West. When the French dominate Vietnam, many young Vietnamese are thinking, what does it mean to be Vietnamese? Now that this foreign culture, these foreign people are dominating us, why are we weak? Why are they strong? Maybe it has something to do with their ideas. Well, what are their ideas? And what do we do with our ideas? I really am fascinated by this encounter between cultures.
And that's why we're here at Nguyen Khắc Viet. Makes sense, because he's a cultural activist, actually. But, you know, we've been covering a lot of political theorists in the first dozen or so episodes. And now here we are, cultural activists.
Well, so let's jump into him, okay? So, we are discussing Nguyen Khắc Viet, born in 1913, died in 1997. He is a really significant Vietnamese revolutionary figure. He's a historian, he's a writer, he's a journal editor. And I'll say it right now, he is a really orthodox Marxist-Leninist. He is a propagandist for the Vietnamese communists. So for those of you who are sympathetic to that ideology, you're going to like him. But if you oppose the Vietnamese communists and their ideology, don't turn this episode off just yet. I still think that he has really interesting theories and he raises questions that are important for all of us, whether we're sympathetic or unsympathetic to socialism. Here are a few important things about him. He really is a big, big deal. If you go to Vietnam today, if you go to the airport and you look at where they sell books, you're going to find his book everywhere. His famous book on Vietnamese history, Vietnam, Một Thiên Lịch Sử, Vietnam, A History. In 1992, he was awarded the Grand Prix of the Francophonie by the Académie Française. So this is France's official authority on the French language. This is a huge deal, giving him this prize. By the way, it's very ironic because it's a very bourgeois prize and he's a total Marxist communist. And some people were very upset that he won the prize. And we'll talk about this later because, well, he is known for defending Vietnam's Stalinist regime. He was also for a moment arguably attracted to fascism. More on that later. Now, another interesting thing is that he promoted breathing exercises, like a mix of yoga, tai chi, meditation. If you YouTube videos of, you can watch videos of them online, and you can see him doing these breathing exercises. So he really cares about the body. You learned a bit about that too, right? Like when you were doing some research on him.
They said he was like the father of Vietnamese yoga.
Yeah. Listeners might also be interested. Actually, Ian and I discuss him on a episode of Nam Phong Dialogues. It was an episode on Vietnamese Marxist intellectuals. So she discussed Trần Đức Thảo and I discussed Nguyen Khắc Viet. But today I'm going to discuss a bit more. And I also want to have a discussion with you, Ken, about some of the key themes that I want to examine. I'll mention that briefly, but a little bit more on how he is viewed by people. So he is really disliked and criticized by various scholars outside of Vietnam today. I remember I was in Paris a few months ago and I was talking to this Vietnamese scholar of Vietnamese history and I mentioned his name. And this scholar just had the most disgusted look on her face when I mentioned his name. And I said, so why don't you like him? And she said, oh, he's so dogmatic and orthodox. It's just a Marxist. He's, you know, not interesting. So, and also scholars will criticize him for, well, I will go into that later, but I will say, I'll just say that for now. But for now, he is a figure that was really favored by American anti-war academics. So these are American academics who essentially reproduce the narrative of the Vietnamese Communist Party. You know, the whole narrative that it was not a civil war. This was a war between the Vietnamese people against American imperialists and their puppets, you know, that whole narrative that we're used to, right? He is really a promoter of that narrative, which I mean, to me, Ken, to me, it's so obviously, and you know what? Maybe I will have this discussion with you right now.
Right now. What's fanatic about this?
I hear all the time from, let me start over. When I call the Vietnam War a civil war, I get pushback from people from Vietnam. And it's not surprising. You're not allowed to call it a civil war in Vietnam.
So the Vietnamese government official narrative is this was not a civil war. This was a war between the Vietnamese people kicking out the American imperialists.
Right. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, of course it was a civil war. That's like saying I'm not holding a cup in my hand right now. Like, that statement does not match the objective reality. And the objective reality is that Vietnamese people were fighting and killing Vietnamese people. And then I'm trying to think to myself, how could someone say that it was not a civil war? And I thought of two things. Number one, you can make that argument if you simply consider that the people who fought with the Americans against the communists, that they weren't Vietnamese, that they simply gave up their Vietnameseness. You know, they are traitors to the Vietnamese people. If you think that way, then you can say, yeah, it was not a civil war, because it's not Vietnamese against Vietnamese. It's Vietnamese against people who are not Vietnamese anymore. That's one possibility. Another possibility is, if you think of North Vietnam and South Vietnam as sovereign countries, then you could say it's an international war, I think, not a civil war. You know, because it's a war between two sovereign nations.
Right.
That's another way of thinking about it. But, I mean, I think it was Vietnamese people fighting Vietnamese people. Both sides call each other puppets. And also, here's another thing I hear a lot. I hear the Northern Communist side called the South Vietnamese puppets. And then I'm thinking to myself, well, if they were really puppets of the Americans, well, Americans died in that war. Masters don't typically die with their puppets. Masters typically make the puppets do all the dying. And so by that logic, you can say that the Soviet Union and China were the masters of the puppets in the North, if you want to make that argument.
Right.
You know, I prefer to not call anybody puppets, because I think they're thinking for themselves. Now, it is true, however, that America had certain interests and they wanted to use the South Vietnamese, and the South Vietnamese wanted to use them. And so, anyway, that this is my ramble about the whole
War. But you could also say that about China and Russia as it pertains to the North Vietnamese. Same thing.
Exactly.
Everybody, There's superpowers that finance and fund wars for their own agendas as well. But I think when I think about all this controversial stuff, I think sometimes all of it can be right. You know, all of it can exist in some weird way in some people's minds and some government minds. And, you know, depending on what context you're talking about in conversation at in the classroom or dinner, it's
right. And just to remind listeners, I mean, the Civil War, the fight between Vietnamese people did not start during the Second Indochina War, what we call the Vietnam War. It started as early as 1947. So during the First Indochina War, when the Viet Minh, it was supposed to be a coalition between every Vietnamese who wanted to kick out the French, whether you're communist or not communist, you join the Viet Minh. But as soon as that coalition got started, you started seeing tensions within it, and then they started devolving, and then you had some non-communists defecting onto the French side. This was happening in the south of southern Vietnam. Anyway, I don't want to get into that, but that's just one thing I wanted to say. Okay, let's go back to Nguyen Khắc Việt. So today, what I want to do is I want to focus on three things in Nguyen Khắc Việt's thoughts. I want to talk about his thought on how revolution happens. How does anti-colonial revolution and communist revolution happen? And then I want to talk about his thoughts on Confucianism. And then lastly, I want to talk about his thoughts on free speech, because this is a big theme. And This is going to be very interesting. Sound good?
Sounds great. I'm interested, so interested in how revolutions happen, because, you know, I think living in the States, sometimes we could see the disparity between rich and poor. And I think when that sort of happens in the world, you know, like the French Revolution, revolution starts to happen. People start to, you know, pitchfork time, and they just go out and
Oh yeah. Good, good. How do revolutions happen? This is the episode for that. So, okay. So quick bio. Nguyễn Khắc Viễn was born in 1913 to a scholarly family, a scholar gentry family in Hanoi. When he was in his early 20s, he studied medicine in Hanoi, and then he moved to France in 1937 to continue his studies. He stayed in France for 26 years. And when he was in France, he was a really active voice in Vietnamese anti-colonial communities. So he wrote a lot of articles talking about Indochina, explaining it to the West. Like, he's trying to promote the anti-colonial cause. And he published in French journals like La Pensée, La Nouvelle Critique, La Nouvelle Démocratie, La Jeune Afrique, all these French journals for leftists and progressives and so on. In the late 1940s, he joined the French Communist Party. And then he was expelled from France in 1963 for his communist activities. He returned to Vietnam and he joined the Vietnamese Communist Party. And then in 1992, as I had mentioned, he receives France's Grand Prix de la Francophonie for his work as a historian, translator, editor, publisher of journals such as Études Vietnamiennes, Vietnamese Studies, and Courrier du Vietnam, the Vietnam Courier. Now, this is interesting because when he receives this prize, he's really criticized by some Vietnamese in France because, well, this is pretty controversial. When the Nazis were in power, he accepted a scholarship to study in Berlin. And this is during the Second World War. I mean, this is, this is 1943. And by then, like, the Nazis were, they had begun mass deportation of French Jews. I live in Amsterdam. They were taking Jews to Auschwitz by 1942. I mean, bad stuff was happening. And now I guess one can question, how much did he know about this bad
stuff? That's what I was going to ask you. Yeah.
You know, he took a scholarship. If you really want to defend him on this, you can say, well, yeah, I'll take your money wherever it goes, whoever it belongs to, I'll take the money, you know. But so he's going to be criticized for that. But also, in some of his writings, he does show an interest in fascism. And we have to remind ourselves, Ken, that in France in the 1930s, there were a lot of Vietnamese young people who were attracted to fascism. Can you guess why? Why would a young Vietnamese person in the 1930s be attracted to fascism?
I think the control that fascism appears to bring is enticing to a young Vietnamese person who's living under the chaos of a colonial rule. That's my guess.
I think that's a good guess. I think that's part of the answer. Another answer is simple. Fascism is simply extreme nationalism.
Yeah.
And if you're anti-colonial, if you're sick and tired of your people being stepped on by a colonial power, one solution is nationalism, where you want to unite all your people to fight against them. Now, that's one solution, nationalism. But we have to remember that communism or Marxism is not nationalist. It is proletarian internationalist. The most important thing for a communist is not nationalism. It's workers of the world unite. Now, this is actually going to get more complicated when we bring in Lenin and when we bring in Ho Chi Minh, because they are going to use nationalism towards their ultimate goal of communist proletarian internationalism. So for Ho Chi Minh, you have to fight a revolution in two stages. First, you have to do a nationalist anti-colonial revolution where you get rid of the French, and then you have to do a communist revolution where you get rid of classes in Vietnam?
You know, I think I have to bring up something, Professor, because this gnaws at me. It gnaws at my insides a lot. When we talk about communism, present day Vietnam is still communist. But how does capitalism work inside of this with such strong history of all of these proletariat ideas, this theory that communism is Vietnam and Vietnam is communism today, but clearly there's all this capitalism working. So what are we talking about now?
So Ken, that's a great question. That's a fascinating question. I do want to pull you back into the 1940s now, but I will quickly say that there are many different answers to your question. Some in Vietnam are going to say, well, in order to get to communism, you have to go through the historical stage of capitalism first. Some will say that Vietnam is going through that stage. Some will say that Vietnamese people are still struggling. Communism is a process. It's a struggle. It's not a black and white thing. We will talk more about what communism is, but essentially, there's socialism as a stage that precedes communism. So this is the Leninist view of revolution. Socialism is a stage where the government is centralizing the economy, and so there's state control of the economy. And then communism is this almost utopian-like stage where classes wither away and the state withers away. Now, for the Vietnamese Marxists, and we will talk more about this when we get into Nguyen Cac Vien. So just let me finish the bio, and then we'll get to the revolution part of it. But that is a good question. Okay. So Nguyen Cac Vien will later, in his memoir and his later works, decry fascism. He's going to say the Nazis were bad, right? But his writings do romantically portray the Vietnamese communist movement and Vietnamese history as leading up to the Vietnamese Communist Party's victory in 1975. Like, the whole purpose of all this struggle is to have the Communist Party in power. So he's going to dismiss the anti-communist Vietnamese as puppets of the United States. Oh, by the way, we had talked about the Civil War, you know, earlier. I realize another response from somebody who doesn't think it's a civil war, what they could say is they could say that the Vietnamese people who opposed Ho Chi Minh were so small in number to be insignificant. That's something else they might say. But then we would have to say, well, is that true? Like, is that really true?
No.
I mean, how many hundreds of, was it like 200,000 South Vietnamese soldiers died in the Vietnam War? Do you know the number? 300,000?
I don't know the exact number, but if you think about how many died, 10 times as many lived, which is, let's say, you know, I mean, if there was 200,000 people, soldiers that died, there were many more times that existed in that army to fight against the North. So it's not just a small number that you can sneeze at.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, that's a side thing, but Nguyen Cac Vien will dismiss them as puppets of the United States. And so for these reasons, some scholars have argued that he has been favored by anti-war American academics of the 60s and 70s who tend to paint a simplistic history of the 20th century in Vietnam. So Nguyen Cac Vien dies in 1997, and he's buried in a cemetery reserved for high-ranking state leaders. Okay, so let's now turn to three really interesting themes that show up in his writings: revolution, Confucianism, and free speech. So let's start with revolution. How does a revolution happen? You know what, Ken? I think this is a relevant question, especially for young people today. I mean, let's not hide behind it. A lot of young people are angry at inequality today, and some are becoming more attracted to ideas of socialism and Marxism and communism. I really think that these old Marxist thinkers in Vietnam, you know, this used to be old stuff of the Cold War, and then they kind of, you know, people forget about them. But I think we're seeing a revival in interest in this study now.
You look really excited to talk about it. So you're bringing on the revival.
No, you know, I also had a lot of coffee, so maybe that's it. Anyway.
I do agree with you. I think that the economy looks bleak in America. I think people are trying to make sense of Trump. And I think to a lot of young people, this idea of revolution is juicy. It's like they think about it.
Yeah. So let me start with a name, Frantz Fanon. Have you heard of Frantz Fanon?
I have not.
Yeah. So if you're a young leftist or progressive in college, you definitely have heard of Frantz Fanon. He's a very famous Black anti-colonial writer. He's a philosopher. He's a psychiatrist from Martinique, a French colony in the Caribbean. Very, very influential writer who wrote a very famous book that was published in 1961 called Wretched of the Earth, The Wretched of the Earth. And it was essentially about colonialism. He's trying to explain the relationship between the colonizer and the colonized, and he's trying to explain what that relationship is and how anti-colonial revolts happen. And the reason why I'm bringing up Frantz Fanon is because he's so influential. Like, he influenced anti-colonial movements all around the world. His works were translated into dozens of languages. Frantz Fanon was cited by the Black Panthers, the Latin American guerrilla movement, the Palestine Liberation Organization, Islamic revolutionaries in Iran, like all over the place. But here's what's really interesting. Fanon did not inspire the Vietnamese people. In fact, it was the other way around. Fanon was really inspired by the Vietnamese. So in The Wretched of the Earth, there is a very famous question that Fanon says, which is, he says, look at Dien Bien Phu. That was amazing. How do we create more Dien Bien Phus? His whole book can be read as a response to that question that he presents to the world. You know, and he's like, let's do more Dien Bien Phu. So he's going to really look up to and admire the Vietnamese. But what's really interesting and amusing to me is that the Vietnamese, like, I looked into this. I've researched this with a co-author from the University of Chicago, Julian Goh. We have an article under review right now. It's called Fanon's Vietnam, Vietnam's Fanon. And we were trying to figure out, were the Vietnamese ever influenced by Fanon? The answer is no. Like, Fanon was never translated into Vietnamese. None of his works were. The only Vietnamese person who engaged with Fanon is Nguyen Khắc Việt. And Nguyen Khắc Việt criticizes Fanon. Nguyen Khắc Việt criticizes Fanon for having the wrong ideas. And I think this is so interesting because everybody loves Fanon. Every leftist revolutionary anti-colonialist loves Fanon. But here you have a Vietnamese thinker who's saying, Fanon, you're like a schoolboy. You're really, Fanon sees himself as a student to the Vietnamese who are his teachers. And Nguyen Khắc Việt, like, sees Fanon as a student, which makes sense because by the time Fanon publishes Wretched of the Earth in 1961, 7 years have already passed since the Vietnamese kicked out the French in Dien Bien Phu. At this point in time, the Vietnamese are in the north, are trying to do a socialist revolution in the north. Fanon, meanwhile, is interested in anti-colonialism, but the Vietnamese are like, we already did that. Like, so Fanon is trying to learn from them, right? So anyway, Nguyen Khắc Việt writes a famous essay where he essentially criticizes Fanon. So this essay is called Frantz Fanon, and it's written in French, Et les problèmes de l'indépendance. So Frantz Fanon and the problems of independence. So basically what Nguyen Khắc Việt says is that Fanon is wrong. So Fanon claimed that the only revolutionary class in society are the peasants, that the peasants are the only revolutionary class. But Nguyen Khắc Việt is going to say, no, Fanon, you're wrong. There are other revolutionary classes in colonial society. So they are the bourgeois class and the working class in the cities. And you need those classes in the cities. like peasants will never do a revolution on their own.
Right.
This is Nguyen Khắc Viên says. You can, colonialists can oppress the peasants, but they'll never do a revolution on their own. Peasants will revolt and they'll do riots and they'll get violent, but they will not do a revolution. A revolution is when you radically change society, when you change the power relations, when you create a new world, essentially. The people who are revolutionaries are actually from the cities who are more educated. Only they have ideas of democracy, for example, like new ideas, right? So Fanon was famous for arguing that the working class in the cities are pampered by colonizers, and so they are not really revolutionary. And but Nguyen Khắc Viên is going to say, no, you're wrong. So Nguyen Khắc Viên is going to say, peasants will remain peasants. They won't know how to lead the revolutionary movement. The driving forces of revolution must be carefully distinguished from those who lead it. So he does say that the peasants are the driving force of a revolution. You need peasants. I mean, most of Vietnamese society was peasants. Most of Vietnam were peasants. So you need them on your side, but they are not the ones who can lead the revolution. You need educated people. You need people with ideas. Fanon thought that revolutions just happen like a burst of violence. Almost like if you kick a dog, the dog will bite back. You know, it's almost like Fanon thought it was like a natural reaction. People will react with violence. But Nguyen Khắc Viên is going to say, no, you need to dedicate yourself to political work. You need to engage in ideological education and things like that. So it's not just violence, it's political work. I think this is also interesting because he talks about violence as you need to be like a surgeon. So Fanon is going to say that the colonized person is oppressed and then they're going to react with violence. They're going to burst out with violence. But Nguyen Khắc Viên is going to say, no, you need to be like a surgeon where you have to know what to cut, you know, and to not cut more. Then otherwise you're going to cut the wrong things.
Right.
You need to be more careful. So he says, political and ideological work is crucial during revolutionary wartime and post-revolutionary peacetime. Violence, armed struggle, releases this unexpected energy. And so what you need to do is to rein in this energy and channel it towards nation building. So he says, we have seen those who collaborated with the enemy, they need to be re-educated. And we're going to talk about re-education later in this episode. And so he says they need to be reintegrated, which requires imagination and long-term work. And he says, in Vietnam, after Vietnamese fighters have expelled the French, we have seen them return to their opium dens after 9 years of combat. So that's another problem for Nguyen Khắc Viên. When you have Vietnamese fighting the French, being very heroic, but then they go back to being drug addicts, right? And he says, we have seen peasants, after having waged guerrilla warfare for years, be once again afraid of ghosts because their political confidence in the party leading them was shaken by errors committed over the course of agrarian reform. So he's referring to the land reforms. So Nguyen Khắc Viên is like asking some pretty good questions. He's like, if the party makes mistakes during the land reform and the people lose confidence in the party, what should the party do?
Right.
Right. And when people return to their opium dens, what should we do? So,
you know, I just want to interrupt. The craziest thing that I think about while you're telling me this information is the same patterns repeat itself in other countries, like the United States. You have all of these homeless people hooked on opiates in the United States, in Ohio, Pennsylvania, all these, you know, states that war veterans come back home to And they can't shake these ghosts. They can't shake these feelings of guilt or shame or whatever. And the government doesn't have a real place to try, you know, with VA centers, but it's the same patterns of humanity replaying itself in modern history today.
There you go. And, but also, so Wenkak Vien is talking about a communist party, a Leninist party, where they are supposed to be the leaders leading the revolution. And so they have a responsibility, that the communist party leaders have a responsibility to help these veterans. And so there's a fascinating essay that he wrote called The Judo Lesson, which is really interesting. So do you know anything about judo? I don't really.
Judo, as I understand, is like wrestling, Japanese wrestling, and a little bit like Hapkido, I think, where you take the momentum of, you know, your opponent to kind of submit them.
Okay, right there. So this is great. So he says he's trying to explain how a weak nation like Vietnam was able to defeat a powerful one like France. And he essentially says, Ho Chi Minh and Lenin showed us the way. And what they showed specifically was that colonized peoples should be like judo fighters. They should take advantage of the contradictions of capitalism and imperialism by using the misery that it generates against itself, like how a judo fighter uses the opponent's own movement. So I'm going to quote him. Your opponent is movement. It is in that same movement, not in your own strength, that you must find the force to defeat your opponent. Grab his moves at the end of their thrust. Prolong them, and you will lure your adversary into a fall which he himself has precipitated. So essentially what he's saying is, look, capitalism necessarily generates misery. I mean, that's just what it does, objectively, because, I mean, capitalism is private ownership of the means of production for private profit. And if you're a capitalist, your goal is to make as much profit as you can. And so you pay as little of a wage as you possibly can. And what that does is it creates inequality, and the workers are going to be immiserated. So what Wenkak Vien is saying is, like, look, if you see miserable workers, that's an opportunity. You have to use that anger of theirs and to use it against capitalism itself. So he says, one must pay particular attention to workers and poor peasants, because when these people acquire national consciousness and class consciousness, the match will be won. So that's the formula for a Marxist-Leninist. You know, find angry poor people and then get them to think that their enemy are the capitalists. And then once they believe that, it is like a religious revelation to them. You know, I've been reading some testimonies I'm reading a book right now about ex-communists, people who used to be communists and then they left communism. But they were describing their revelation when they started reading Marx and Lenin, how intoxicating, like, once you understand Marx and Lenin, like, everything is explained, like, the whole world is explained, you know? It really is kind of like a religion. It's like a religious conversion, like a promise of a better future, you know?
But how does it account for people's differences in their ambitions? I've always wondered about that. And I haven't studied enough Marxism, obviously. But I always wondered, communism is based on, you know, this model where you don't have the extreme poors and extreme riches. But then the reason capitalist societies work is because everybody's sort of allowed to kind of live out their ambitions.
Yeah, I think this is a good question. I mean, it is true that Lenin, his view of a socialist society would be one where you actually get rid of human differences, human diversity, you know? But at the same time, if I'm going to be sympathetic to Ho Chi Minh's vision, he's going to actually say that actually it's socialism that allows for human diversity to flourish, because in capitalism, only the diversity of the few people flourish, like the capitalist class. Meanwhile, you have factory workers who, like, their individual identity is just purely suppressed. Like, there's no freedom for them there. You know, there are people who are going to argue that it's really socialism that's going to allow the flourishing of various human ambitions. You can pursue your desire to be a painter, a musician, or whatever. They're going to say, we just don't want you to exploit and take advantage of the labor of other people. Like, you can have a business, but don't exploit people. I think there's an argument and room within the socialist tradition to argue, you know, to give room to diversity and human ambition here. Anyway, so, okay. Nguyễn Khắc Vinh essentially is going to say that revolutions happen when leaders, visionary leaders, who have the vision of communist revolution, take advantage of the anger of workers and poor peasants and guide them. So those intellectuals need to go into the countryside and teach the peasants. And what Fanon got wrong is that Fanon saw the peasants' revolt, but he didn't see that there was a lot of work behind that on the part of the intellectuals. So Nguyễn Khắc Vinh says he just saw an optical illusion. Anyway, let's now turn to Confucianism. This is really interesting. So Nguyễn Khắc Vinh wrote an essay in 1962 called Marxism and Confucianism in Vietnam. And in it, he talks about his parents' generation, how they studied Confucianism, and how his generation didn't know anything about Confucianism. And this is really interesting. It's quite touching, actually, quite moving, because he's going to say that Confucianism is a social philosophy that teaches that leaders will gain followers through being virtuous. That's how you gain followers. If you want to be a leader, you need to be a virtuous person. You need to be a good person, a moral person with integrity, with righteousness. You don't lie, you don't steal. You are kind to others, you care for others. And so Nguyễn Khắc Vinh, he says, his generation had learned what the Confucian scholars of his father's generation lacked. So his generation learned physics, algebra, political theory, Marxism, democracy, constitutions. And then he says, but when we compared ourselves with the traditional scholars whom we saw every day, we definitely felt that they had something we lacked. Their knowledge was relatively limited, but they were men. They were the bamboo trees, which remained tall, pines that withstood the adversities of winter. They would bend under the breeze, but they never broke. So he says essentially that they had deeply rooted moral convictions, whereas we didn't. Isn't that interesting? Yeah. Like the generations' education, like they have, one generation has something that the other doesn't.
Yeah. That's today. I mean, it's almost a comparison between older people and younger people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, perhaps. Right. So he's going to say that Confucianism has a lot in common with Marxism. Number one, they're both social philosophies that care about this life. They're not religions in the sense that they care about an afterlife.
Right.
In Marxism, the goal is to make a good world in this life. That's why Marxists call religion the opiate of the masses, because Christianity is very helpful for capitalists sometimes, because if a worker is being exploited, they can just be convinced that they need to sacrifice this life and then their next life when they're dead will be better. And that makes a capitalist happy, right? But now, to be fair, there are Catholic, Christian, Marxist. There's a whole tradition of that in Latin America called liberation theology. So that's, you know, it's more complicated. But anyway, Confucianism is not a religion in the sense that it has nothing to say about the afterlife. It's all about what kind of social relations are good in this life. How should you behave towards others in this life? And even Ho Chi Minh is going to say, communism is going to be easier for East Asian Confucian societies to do because we already care about the community.
Right.
Like that. That's communism, you know. Another thing that he marries between Confucianism and Marxism is that they both emphasize leadership. So Lenin is going to say you need a vanguard of professional revolutionaries. And then, like, Confucianism says you need to be a good leader. I'm moving pretty quickly, I realize, and I realize that we could still have some discussion here. But anyway, let me take a break real quick. What do you think so far of Nguyễn Khắc Viễn? I mean, what are some things that you are convinced of or that you're critical of?
You know, when I think about any form of government or any ways of living, whether it's in the United States or Vietnam today, I think there's many things that can be right and many things that can be wrong all at the same time. I don't think now as I expand my understanding of Vietnam and the United States, I feel like people living in each place, you have to sacrifice some things and you have to like accept some great things, you know? That's just sort of like when I listen to you describe Nguyễn Khắc Viễn, I think about the things that he says. It's like, I understand the context of like why he would support, you know, these ideologies, because at the time you kind of have to. And I agree with about, you know, the managers, the project managers of a revolution, they have to be educated. They have to come with a certain understanding of how political capital and this workflow of leadership happens. You know, and I think we are on the brink of that in the United States. I feel like at any moment, this, you know, we all believed, you know, the majority of the people voted for President Trump and believe a certain outcome, but it looks pretty grim, you know, 100 days in, and things look pretty grim. And I think that, you know, in my heart and in my mind, the idea of people not being able to pay their mortgages and falling behind on rent and food and shortages, all because, you know, one person makes a decision and thinks that it's going to all pay off in about a year. But we're, you know, I think the country doesn't live like that. And any country in history is constantly, you know, living paycheck to paycheck. And I think Vietnam in the 40s and 50s are, you're one paycheck away from starvation sometimes. So it you know, all of this stuff is resonating with me during this time as I'm hearing this man's life.
Yeah. I mean, the question for somebody who wants to change society, who wants to create an alternative to this system of where people are suffering, living paycheck to paycheck while others are billionaires, they're going to have to think about what kind of ideas to promote to get people to follow, to create a political movement. You know, this is the kind of political work that Nguyễn Khắc Viễn was talking about. So the question of, well, is the answer communist revolution? Well, that's had a bad history, as we know, right? But at the same time, there are young people today who are trying to rethink, well, how else can we imagine a socialist movement that does care about freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and so on?
But here's the problem. Young people who are thinking about how to re-establish the establishment, when you are a young person and you are starting to think about that, you are automatically not working class anymore. If you're thinking about this, if you're like, how do I project manage this? You're already becoming an intellectual. And when you become an intellectual, I think you become removed from the actual working class. So I think there's this sort of like stretch.
Yeah, but at the same time, absolutely, I agree with you. But if you're a good Marxist, you would be aware of that. And then you would realize that you need to stay in touch with the working class. You would go back and forth. You would study. You would hang out with workers. You would talk with them. You would go back and forth.
But I think that's where the big disconnect is happening. You know, because the kids, the young people who are now thinking nowadays, who have the means to have this free time and not work at a factory, and they're in school, they're getting an education, they can immediately just cross over and start making money in the real world because they have these ideas.
Temptation, for sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so this ideal of staying in touch with workers on a factory line, what are they going to talk about? I think that's where the breakdown happens. However, I do have a lot of friends in LA who are, you know, postgraduate, you know, degrees that still, you know, march and still very active in the world of protests. So I think, yeah, it could happen as well.
Yeah. Well, okay. So turning back to Nguyễn Khắc Vinh, I think one of the things that we're touching on right here is, how do you generate power for your movement? Now, what I mean by power is, I'm just going to quote a famous philosopher named Hannah Arendt. I think she gave a good definition of power. And for her, power is the human capacity to act in concert. So you're simply acting together with other humans. So power requires a kind of consensus, maybe even friendship and love and agreement. You know, you all put your fist in the air, you say yes. It's like you all feel the same thing together and you work together. So power, therefore, never exists within an individual. So if we say that someone is powerful, what we really mean is that other people have empowered that person to act and speak on their behalf, right? So power exists so long as the group sticks together. So if we talk about a powerful army, they're powerful because they work together, right? So that's the struggle. Like, how do you create a powerful movement to resist, you know, the fascists, right? How do you create a powerful resistance movement? How do you create a powerful movement to resist colonizers? This was the question. And the one point that I want to make in this episode is that, one of the points is that for Nguyễn Khắc Vinh, Marxism-Leninism was simply the most compelling, convincing theory, explanation of why colonialism was happening and what could be done about it. You know, now at this point in the episode, I now want to move on to this. It's good that we're moving on to this part now. So now the Vietnamese, they have kicked out the French, and now they have beat, in Nguyễn Khắc Vinh's words, the American imperialists and their puppets. I'm taking his perspective now here. Now what, right? Let's turn to re-education camps. So as we have talked many times in this series before, we have family who were in re-education camps. I now want to talk about what he says about free speech. So in 1991, Nguyễn Khắc Vinh gave a letter or a speech to the leaders in the Communist Party. And I'm going to quote him here. He says, quote, "Freedom of the press, of association, of petition, of demonstration, to strike are the forms of struggle of our epoch. They are proven means that can lead to profound reforms." Now, I essentially took this quote out of context, but I just said the quote. I mean, the quote itself seems to be saying that he believes in free speech, right? In the speech, he also says that the party leaders are too old. It's become a gerontocracy. They need to step down and younger people need to take their place. Now, some historians are going to say, it looks like Nguyễn Khắc Vinh might be arguing for free speech and a liberal democracy, but not really. It's true that Nguyen Khắc Vien is critiquing the corruption of the Communist Party, and he's promoting a popular democratic front, but we should not misunderstand this to mean a liberal democratic state. What he really wants is to resist the forces of private economic development and foreign investment that were now infecting the Doi Mai movement in Vietnam after Doi Mai. So after Doi Mai, what do you see, right? You see a lot of foreign investment. You see more capitalism coming in. Nguyen Khắc Vien wants to say, be careful. Let's not succumb to these evil forces of capitalism. We need to resist that. And so he's going to call for free speech. But what he means by that is speech that serves communist revolution.
Yeah.
And I also want to ask, you know, how does he reconcile this, what seems to be a defense of free speech, with his defense of re-education camps? So he's going to defend re-education camps. Now, I need the listener to be careful here because I'm now quoting him. I'm sharing his perspective. This is not my perspective. This is his perspective. So he's going to say that after the Vietnam War, they put former enemies into re-education camps. And he says, there are, quote, officers responsible for massacres and crimes under the excuse of executing American policy. They were directly involved in shooting people, in burning villages, in torturing people. If we let them go free, it's possible that they might join some of these armed counter-revolutionary elements that we talked about, or they might try to sabotage the economy and organize a counter-revolution in some other way. We therefore have to keep them in re-education camps. We don't torture them. We don't shoot them. Instead, we ask them to think about what has happened and to tell about their past. Those who, according to their dossiers, are not considered dangerous are allowed to go free. What do you make of that quote?
What year was that? What is that said in?
Oh, gosh. Okay. I can find this out.
I mean, was it shortly after, you know, 1975? Was it in 78, 79? Or was it at 91? You know, was it later? Because I think there's context to all of it. If he says it in the early, days, like 76, 77, he is responsible for hundreds of, you know, thousands of people who are locked up from our side. And I think that created pain in our families, and we have to acknowledge that. And I think if it was said in 91, 92, before he died in 97, I think that's a different context as well. Both are not right, I think, when he... And here's why I say that. There's a really powerful woman ambassador from Vietnam, Vietnamese ambassador to the EU. And she's still living. Her name is Thong Nhu That Minh. And she recently said that it was a mistake. She said, hopefully one day the Vietnamese government can admit to the mistake of locking up former South Vietnamese government. She said it. She said it on record, unless it's some AI trick that I don't know about, right? But she said it. She said she believes that in her heart, the re-education camps were a mistake. And one day she hopes that the Vietnamese government will admit to it and acknowledge this. I think the Vietnamese communist government has made two mistakes, or openly has thought of two mistakes: land reform and the re-education camps, right?
So, look, I'm not going to defend re-education camps. I do think he raises an interesting question for all societies that have engaged in war. You know, when you are the side that wins, what do you do with the former enemies? Really, I mean, it's a serious question. What do? You can't kill them all.
You relabel. Wow, yeah, you can't. You can't kill them all. You can't.
So what do you do?
You got to re-educate them to reintegrate them back into society.
Is that a serious answer, Ken? Or
no, I'm saying what the Vietnamese government did.
But now I'm asking you, Ken, if you were on a side that wins, what would you do with a former enemy?
I would say this. Hey, guys, you have 2 years to pack up your stuff and get out. And if we see you meddling in the affairs of the government, we will put you to death. But you have 2 years, 5 years to get out, you know?
Oh,
wow. You're allowed to get out. You're allowed to exile yourself. You know, and I speak from a place of ignorance, I admit. I speak from logistically impossible to get 150,000, 200,000 former government officials, elite military people to allow them to evacuate. Like, logistically, what countries would take them on? I mean, and then do you corral them into a pen? You know, like, hey, we're going to just use the island of Phu Quoc for all of you to come here and live, and we'll subsidize it for 2 years. Find a way out, or we will.
But hold on, Ken. But don't you think so? Okay, so that's one option. But what about the option of saying, or you have the opportunity to repent and join our side? Like, would you allow that?
Wow, that's a tough question. A really tough question. And I think listening to my mom and dad talk about the former commanders of the South, that a lot of them was hoping for that option. A lot of them was hoping for the option of, like, okay, guys, white flag, we surrender, integrate us into your administration. A lot of guys were hoping for that. And I think that's something that's not talked about. But a lot of people thought that, hey, they could use our knowledge, they could use our understanding of how this, you know, how this stuff can work. But they were never called upon. They were just locked up. I would give the people two options. I'd like, you can go to Phu Quoc, we'll corral you there, and then you can find your way out. We'll subsidize food, your families for 2 years. Otherwise, you cannot come back in, or you come back in and reintegrate and you sign agreements that you're going to be working for us. That would have been a cool, smooth historic transition, I think, in our country.
Ken, it gets even more complicated. Let's say you have a case of one person who says, look, I'm happy to sign the paper, I'm on your side now, but there's clear evidence that this one person had been engaged in torturing people on your side during the war.
Ooh.
You know?
Or killing them.
Or killing people. Then what?
Then you would have to be one of the guys that get on the plane and find sponsorship in another country. There's ways around this, man. I think that I think in war, we're too quick to move. I mean, and you don't have a lot of time to mobilize 150,000, 200,000 people and their families. So you have to make these decisions. Otherwise, there's going to be more blood on your hands and people dying and chaos. So I think you have to make these swift decisions. So when I think about these wartime sort of post-war decision-making, they don't know. They're not thinking about, they're not reading history books to figure this out. You know, we have the luxury of sitting right here, hindsight 50 years, and we are armchairing the hell out of this topic.
And it's a good thing to do. We should have discussions like this. So, okay, but this was a good thoughts discussion exercise, you know. A few more things that I want to say about Nguyen Khắc Vien. What's interesting is that he really promotes freedom of religion. However, it's interesting how he does it. Of course, so he does it within limits. So he says, I'm quoting him, as to the freedom of religion, all religion is permitted and practiced. The Catholic Church has an official position. The Archbishop of Saigon has declared that the duty of Catholics is to cooperate with the revolutionary power. With the Buddhists, the position is similar, and the Buddhists are better placed since Buddhism has been a national religion. This is kind of amusing to me because essentially he's saying, look, we promote freedom of religion as long as you're on our side. I mean, that's what he's saying, essentially, that as long as you're with the revolution, then freedom for you. Now, I'm not I'm not mocking him, actually. In fact, in all societies limit freedom of speech.
Yeah, no matter what you think, there's limitations to all of this freedom of speech and freedom of religion.
Yeah. Here's another really, this is really interesting, Ketz. So he mentions the Nyanvan Zaifa, the free speech movement in the mid-50s. And it's fascinating how he refers to them. He says, a group of intellectuals who believed that the era of national and world revolution had ended, waged a major campaign to demand art for art's sake and a cultural life free of revolutionary considerations. Wow. He's criticizing these artists for doing what he calls art for art's sake. And that's bad. He thinks all art should be for the revolution. This is really interesting, right? Because essentially the people who make art for art's sake, that should not be okay. That should not be allowed. Only revolutionary art should be allowed.
That is crazy. That is but I mean, contextually, when you're having so little resource of those years in a country that's so poor, then you're like, why would you put any energy into things that do not move the people, that cannot propagandize society, right? Like, you're going to do art just because you want to express some individual kind of thoughts and thinking? This is absurd. Whereas I think in the West, it's the only thing to do is to express individualism, and your individuality is the most paramount of importance.
Until your society is falling apart and you and your state is falling apart, then the moment you have a weak state that is unable to protect your rights, then you have a problem. Then is it even, would you want to spend your time expressing your individuality if you have no government to protect your rights?
Right. Right.
At that point, you need to come together and create a government of some sort. Now, okay, I do want to, two last thoughts about Wing Kekvien and what he thinks about freedom. He does mock this idea of freedom. So he writes in an article in 1945, he's criticizing France's 1789 Declaration of the Rights of Man and Citizen, where it says men are born and remain free and equal in rights. So he mocks this idea, which is not surprising because Marxists tend to mock this liberal notion of freedom. The word free is like a strong wine poured into the minds of most people, yet how few people can see clearly the distant consequences of their actions or fully understand the needs of society down to the last detail. Such a free society was therefore nothing more than the law of the jungle. So what I think he means here is what many Marxists mean when they criticize this notion of freedom. It's like, when you talk about freedom for the individual, what you're hiding is that the outcome of the free decisions of millions of individuals is going to create a situation that is actually oppressive to many. And the example that I've used with some of my students is, think of traffic. I mean, you live in LA. I think you can empathize with this, right? So let's say you have to wait in traffic to get to work, and it's awful. And everybody has to wait in traffic, and it's so bad. One solution is for everybody to have a town hall meeting, and then everybody agrees to take the bus. Now, if everybody gets on the bus, they get to work like three times faster. But once everybody agrees to take the bus, suddenly there are fewer cars on the road. And now some people have an incentive. They look at the road, they're like, ooh, nobody's on the road. I can take my car. And then they get to work faster than everybody else. So then what they do in political science, we call it defecting, right? They're defecting from the agreement. Now, what should we do to that person who defects? Should we punish them somehow? Should we give them a fine? That would be impinging on their freedom. But the point I'm trying to make is that everybody was free to decide for themselves to drive, but that creates a bad situation where everybody's stuck in traffic. The solution is we collectively take control of the situation and we agree to take the bus, right? But that will have your create problems where you have individuals who defect. So what do? You're going to have to be like the communist dictator. Like, no, you cannot do that, right?
That's such a great analogy. Did you come up with that right now?
No. This is Peter Singer and his, he's teaching Marx in his book, Introduction to Marxism. So I'll cite him there for that.
You know, one thing that you didn't talk about is this doctor's love of Vietnamese-style yoga and his development of it, Yung Sin. And I find that to be, because you think of yoga, you think of India, and then you think it's brought woo-woo to the West, to California. But, you know, yoga is being practiced all over Vietnam. Every time I go to Vietnam, I see people doing yoga in the parks. I see yoga in signs, in buildings and gyms. It's a big phenomenon in Vietnam. And I think this shows that it was part of the very early days of Vietnam's formation is Vietnamese yoga.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating how if you are a communist revolutionary, you could use that for your cause too, right? Like if doing yoga creates a stronger person, a more stable, good person for the cause, it's almost like a, you know, improving yourself for a cause. But yeah, I don't know too much about that, actually, what his thoughts on yoga are.
Yeah, I mean, he was just, I think after the whole cultural activism, I think later in his life, he was really into, you know, staying alive longer, and his work in health and wellness space is probably considered one of the godfathers of Vietnamese yoga and wellness.
Yeah.
You know, now I am so curious who the next person will be, because I think you're on a journey to do research and you are learning about these different Vietnamese figures, probably for another book or for some big work. And I can't wait to jump into the next figure.
Likewise.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Christo Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Should GLP-1 weight loss medication like Wegovy and Zepbound cost thousands of dollars? We don't think so. Try LifeMD.com helps provide insurance access to the leading GLP-1 medications. Visit TryLifeMD.com and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0. Listen to Bridget's story after losing 55 pounds and using her insurance for coverage.
LifeMD helped me get covered with my insurance. Finding out that it was covered was huge. I've lost 55 pounds. I am so much healthier now that I've lost the weight. I would never be able to do it without them.
Get started today and check your eligibility for GLP-1 medication with copays as low as $0 at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.